Hello and welcome to Saturn Returns with me, Kagi Dunlop. This is a podcast that aims to bring clarity during transitional times where there can be confusion and doubt.
The real me that had to navigate the real world without drugs and alcohol and parties
and the consequences,
I never felt like enough because now I'm comparing myself to this version that everyone loves. So I don't feel like enough. It's like, is this the only way for me to be able to get that kind of validation? And it was.
But it comes to a point where you have to have like personal sovereignty and be like,
for sure.
Am I going to take ownership of
for
this?
Sure.
Or is it going to own me?
Yeah. And people just start drifting away from you.
I am very excited to be joined by Africa Brooke for this episode of Saturn Returns. I was introduced to Africa's work through Anoni Forbat, who came on the podcast at the beginning of the season. And I wanted to speak to someone specifically about self-sabotage because I find it such an interesting thing. And I definitely am someone that suffers from it quite badly myself, but also the sort of creativity behind my self-sabotaging ways. When I was introduced to Africa's work, I was like, this is my girl. She is a mindset and business coach and an NLP practitioner. And as soon as I started watching her videos on Instagram, I was like, oh, wow, this girl is awesome. And we had the best conversation. It went on so long that I actually had to break this into two parts. So you'll be hearing the second part early next year. But this one, we really focus on addiction, self-sabotaging behaviors, limiting self-belief, and making peace with the past version of yourself, which I think is such an important part of your Saturn Returns journey, because you do change so much and you let go of so many ways of behaving that just aren't serving you anymore, that you've outgrown. And it can be really difficult. It can be a difficult process because there is a sort of death of self, like I've discussed previously, but also to make peace with the person that you used to be. So we really talk about that because both of us have gone through these humongous transitions in terms of the kind of people we are today. And I'm very grateful to now call her a friend after having this meeting with her. So I hope you enjoy it and you learn something from it. And thank you very much for listening. But before we get into the episode, let's check in with our astrological guide for the season, Nora.
So it's a big theme during the Saturn return, this theme of self-sabotage and self-denial, feeling like we are not good enough to receive love unless we have the perfect career, or feeling like we're not good enough to get the career position we want unless we work hard and overdo it at the workplace and kind of compromise ourselves. Saturn return really confronts us with these little fallacies in our self-confidence, and it asks us to show up for ourselves and to become that inner authority that we always have had. It kind of confronts us and obligates us to stop patterns of self-sabotage so that we can thrive and truly mature into the adults that we are meant to become after the Saturn return, which is after the age of 30. The age between 28 and 30 can be very confronting on that front, where we do self-sabotage and we do deny ourselves happiness in some ways. Saturn is really just teaching us, by ways of fear and by ways of obstacles, to choose ourselves and to not compromise ourselves and to not devalue ourselves.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
I'm very excited about this conversation.
Me too.
But also you have a very strong energy. Amazing energy. And that's why I was so excited to meet you, because I was like, oh my God, I can't wait to actually be in the presence of her. And it was as soon as I walked in and I was like, oh my God, she's really the real deal.
Thank you.
Can you explain to everyone a little bit about what you do and who you are?
Yes, absolutely. So my name is Africa. And in terms of what I do, I help people to overcome self-sabotage. I work with people to rewire their way of thinking, to change their mindsets. And self-sabotage is something that I'm just so passionate about, because I could have a PhD
in self-sabotage.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you need to in order to be able to tell people how, like, not to do it.
Right? So I'm an NLP practitioner. So NLP is neuro linguistic programming. It's pretty much like a user's manual for the mind. So it's like really understanding our behavior and the way that we think, but on a subconscious level. So it's working with the subconscious mind. And I'm a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm a mindset coach. And I also work with people in terms of business. So fusing all of those things through a business lens.
That's amazing. I'm not going to lie. When you said the self-sabotaging thing, it stirred a lot of stuff.
Really?
Yeah, because I think, I mean, we're all guilty of it in our own ways. But what I've done a lot of work around myself sabotaging. And we're going to bring this back to 2016 for you, because I think we have some similar experiences in the more obvious ways that one self-sabotages. However, self-sabotaging can be very creative. And because it's not necessarily on a conscious thought level, it can creep up on you. And suddenly you're like, oh, wow, I've just destroyed something I really liked.
Absolutely. And for you, would you say, just so I kind of know, would you say that it's something that now when it shows up, you're very aware of it? Or because of the level of awareness that you have, it shows up in sneakier ways? Because that's how it happens.
It's sneaky. Like at the beginning, I was like, okay, things going well in my life, go out, get drunk, ruin everything.
Yes.
Pretty standard. Yeah. I think a lot of people can relate to that. But it was like very much, I was like, okay, how can I press the destruction button? And it was like, it was deeper than just drinking and being a bit reckless. It was like I was ruining stuff for myself.
Yeah.
And so I did a lot of work around that. But now, it creeps in sneakily.
It does. The one thing that I love to let people know about self-sabotage, and I'll just give a definition of what it is. Essentially, it is when you get in your own way. It's when you won't allow yourself to experience fulfillment, when you won't allow yourself to follow through, when you won't allow yourself to go for the opportunities that you really want, or when things are going well. You know, you start to feel resistance and something on a subconscious level tells you to put a spanner in the works. But the most important thing, and I think this is something that has helped me so much, is understanding that we're not doing it because we hate ourselves. You're not doing it because you truly believe you're a piece of shit who doesn't deserve anything good. No, it's actually a way of preserving yourself. You're protecting yourself from something.
And it
can,
unknown.
Yeah, of the unknown. And it can seem like such an odd thing, you know, because I was thinking to myself, how was I protecting myself by having reckless casual sex? How was I protecting myself by binge drinking and blacking out?
And when you're curious about it in that.
Right? But then I realized that I was protecting myself from facing what was really happening, from facing my traumas, from having a look at my fears. I was protecting myself from loneliness. I thought this was the only way that I could connect with people.
That this was intimacy.
Right, exactly. So I think it's important to realize that it's all about protecting yourself. But now as a self-aware adult, as a self-aware person, you have to find new, healthier ways to protect yourself, right?
So to bring it back for you, because a big part of your journey was 2016, when you went sober.
Yes. 2016, I was 24. I'm 28 now. I finally got sober after 10 years of having such a toxic relationship with drugs and alcohol. And it wasn't in a way where I was physically dependent. It wasn't a case of me drinking or doing drugs every single day, but I was a binge drinker and I was a binge anything. I could not just kind of have a little bit of anything and step away. The intention was always to kind of escape my body and to escape my mind from 14 until 24. But alcohol was my vice. Drugs were a big part of that, but alcohol for me, oh, absolutely. It really was. So I tried 7 times to get sober, consciously tried, but I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
What did that involve?
That involved me saying, verbalizing that I'm not going to be drinking anymore. It involved me trying my best to stay away from the environments that were kind of calling me in. In the beginning, it was moderation, right? And for me, moderation was much more evil than just stopping, because
I get that. I totally get that.
Because my intention was not to kind of just sip the drink or to... It was to get fucked up every single time.
And this is the thing. It's such a personal thing, one's relationship with alcohol.
Yes.
That it's like, it's not very helpful when people are like, oh, well, you don't have a problem, so just like moderate. Because it's literally like saying, okay, go out every night and play Russian roulette with yourself.
Yes, yes. Oh my goodness, that's exactly what it was like.
Mm. And you're like, oh, I survived last night. I can do this thing. And then like a couple of nights later and suddenly you're like waking up and you're like, I have no idea what I did last night.
Kagi, that is exactly what it was like. And I kept people around me, and I didn't realize that it was, I was strategically doing this, but I kept people around me who also had the same drinking behavior, mm-hmm. who also had the same drug taking behavior. And I'm not gonna lie, I had fun. I've had a lot of fun in my life, but I knew just how much I was suffering. And so many people that I speak to, people that message me, people that I know, people that I knew from the past, also knew that this is a very dangerous thing that I'm doing. It's not normal to lose 5 hours of your time to be on autopilot for such a long amount of time.
So would you have these like blackout things where you were walking and talking as Africa, like you were doing stuff, you were going places, but you had no awareness.
I used to have that.
It's terrifying.
Oh my goodness. But it was...
Because it's like you're kind of possessed. Because then the next day people are like, you did this and you were quite funny and you're like... But then like someone's like, but you also did that. And you're like, maybe.
Oh my God, that's the thing. And you know what? I would experience such deep shame. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of enter a room and people loved Fun Time Africa. People fucking loved it. And I loved it because people loved it. It was amazing when it was amazing. You know, you're having so much fun. You don't know when it's going to take a turn. Mm-hmm. And then it all just changes. And you wake up in the morning, waking up in Surrey when the last memory I had was Soho. That happened. I went for lunch in Soho and I woke up in Surrey 2 days later. That's not normal. That's not okay.
Again, there's still a part of me that's like, I love it.
And then you just have a deep intuitive feeling that something happened that shouldn't have happened. I would have no idea. I would just know that that cycle is going to repeat, where I have to apologize for this version of myself that I take with me every time that I go out. And it's like, I try to silence her before we get to the event. We have a little chat. Okay, today is going to be different.
You're not coming out. It's not that. Mine was called Katrina. I'd be like, you're not coming out of your cage. And now people even come up to me today. Like, my friends are like, where's Katrina? I'm like, I hope she's dead. I'm really praying that she's 6 feet under and will never return. So I completely get it.
It was bad.
Because it's a part of you.
Yeah.
But then it's also, you feel in a way so disassociated from
for
it.
For sure.
Would you say that it was a part of you that you weren't owning? Or was it just the alcohol that made you that way?
It was a part of me that I wasn't owning. It was a very repressed part of me. And it's amazing to realize that I'm all of those things now. But at the time, how I would describe it is the part of me that is so confident, the part of me that is so fearless, the part of me that can have a conversation with anyone, the part of me that has so many plans, so many ideas, because this was another thing.
And I know exactly what you were like right now.
And to other people, it sounds amazing because I was very good at manipulating people's perception of me. Also, have to be very honest about something. When you look a certain way and you benefit from pretty privilege, for example, it also creates this persona in an even more amplified way. I would just bullshit my life away. It was exciting.
Sounds but it was great. Also... Katrina and me's like, go on.
But it was so dangerous because the real me that had to navigate the real world without drugs and alcohol and
the
parties
consequences.
And the consequences, I never felt like enough because now I'm comparing myself to this version that everyone loves. So I don't feel like enough. It's like, is this the only way for me to be able to get that kind of validation? And it was.
But it comes to a point where you have to have like personal sovereignty and be like,
for
okay,
sure.
Am I going to take ownership over
for
this?
Sure.
Or is it going to own me?
Yeah. And people just start drifting away from you because that side of you is only fun for a certain amount of time.
For like an hour.
Yeah. I wouldn't kind of stumble everywhere. Maybe there'd be times where I would kind of stumble, yeah, whatever, but I would kind of just be there. But my eyes would
be gone. I get it. I had the same thing. And my friends would be like, your eyes went. And I was like, you know what? I'm done with her tonight. And I would be walking, talking, being the life and soul, but I'm not really...
You're not there.
There.
I'm so thankful we didn't meet.
You know what's interesting though? Because my best friend now, I only met her, or like probably the person I'm closest to, I only met her a year ago.
Okay.
And she hears about this version of me and she's just like, I just can't get my head around.
Oh, for sure.
But kind of like, I get it with you because I had it in me.
Yeah.
But meeting you now, I'm like, you have like the calmest energy. And so it's so interesting that you have that experience.
Chaotic.
What changed and what shifted from you going into that phase?
For me, there wasn't just one thing. It was a collection of incidents for the span of 10 years, mm-hmm, where it had started off being fun. People are entertained by this character. I think by the time I was about 20, that's when I knew there was definitely something wrong, but there was way too much shame to actually speak to anyone about it. So I would just go onto Google and I would just type, is it normal to black out? Is it normal to drink this much? And, you know, I'd read things, but I still wasn't ready to let go of that identity. It was just so powerful.
Well, I was going to say, it was so woven into your identity your friendship groups and everything. Yeah. That you're like, how do I exist without this?
Yes, yes.
And who am I?
Right. I didn't think it was possible. That. Yeah. You know, now I'm able to have conversations about identity and different selves. But when you're in it and when you're that young, you don't have the language for it. It's just happening. And
you have Google.
Yeah, you have Google. That is
it. Black and white.
Right. And you think something is wrong with you. You don't understand, for example, the industry of alcohol, the way that alcohol is advertised, especially for women, you know, all of these things that I know now that I didn't know then. But in 2016, it was just me being exhausted. I think it was more of a spiritual exhaustion. I wasn't even going out that much by that time because I knew I had so much anxiety around even going out because I felt so out of control in my own mind. And I knew that having one glass of wine, it's not what I want. I want to drink everything. Why would I have one?
If you did have one, did it affect you in any way?
No, it didn't. But it would leave me wanting... It would feel so empty because that's not what I wanted. I wasn't drinking for the taste.
Yeah,
I could pretend.
For the escape.
Right, there we go. So,
did it ever come into your dreams?
Alcohol. Only when I got sober.
That happened to me.
Yeah.
Big time.
It happens to so many people.
Like, would you have dreams of what you used to do?
Absolutely. Dreams of me binging.
You know what? I had it like, I mean, I've only just started to stop, but occasionally I have it again. I think it's the subconscious being like, I know you're not doing it, but just please don't do this again.
Yes. And you know what? Something also that would happen to me for about the first 2 years is that if I had gone out and stayed out quite late and had an amazing time, when I woke up in the morning, for a brief moment, I would feel hungover.
A phantom hangover. Yeah, I get this.
What
too.
Is that?
Me and my friend called them phantom hangovers. Because you wake up and you're like, oh, God, I have that shame. You're like, what did I do? And I used to get it after having the dreams as well. And then it takes me like a bit of time to be like, oh, I actually didn't do anything.
Is it almost like because you associated alcohol with fun so much and maybe staying out late that it's sort of
I think it's just for
triggers.
So long in those scenarios, you would do the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's so burnt into your like memory and your muscle memory and your body and your emotions. That it just comes up being like, this is what you would have done. This is how you'd feel. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, and then I would just feel, so grateful that that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
So 2016 was me just being fed up of my own shit. And I had tried 7 times by that time to get sober. Again, as I was saying, I was reading a lot of things. I would maybe go a week. Longest I did was 6 months. And then I ended up having one beer and then I was out for 5 days. So...
We've been there.
Honestly,
we've all been there.
Honestly. Also, I had lost pretty much all my friends. Mm. I only had one person that I still am so close to this very day that understood me, had seen me in those moments, had told me the truth about what she sees when that transition happens and how it's not okay, but not in a way of judging me, kind of trying to help me, to support me. And I had my boyfriend at the time who had met me when I was in that part of my life. And then in our relationship, I got sober. So it was quite easy for me in a social aspect because I didn't have so many people around me to kind of have to navigate sobriety in that. I didn't have many people in my life at that point because of the way that I had been.
Which in a weird way is a bit of a blessing.
Oh, for sure.
Because I think if you're not doing it in the infrastructure of AA or therapy, I believe, and this is only from my personal experience, but it seems similar to yours, that there's a necessary social exile that you have to walk through. And to get sober, basically.
For sure.
And to make those decisions and to let that become a permanent in your new self.
Yes, yes. That's what happened for me. And I think because there was so much space in terms of not many people being in my life, that meant there was so much space for new people to flow into my life that met me at that sober level. I tried AA and I just didn't connect. So I went onto Instagram. As you do. I went onto Instagram and 4 years ago, there wasn't anyone talking about sobriety in the way that they are now.
I mean, it's still quite a taboo subject.
Yeah. And now the good thing is that I feel like a lot of young people are starting to question their relationship with alcohol. They're starting to actually question a lot of systems, and alcohol is a part of that. But 4 years ago, there was nothing. There were just forums with kind of much older people. So I didn't see myself. And especially when it came to Black people, African people, I did not see myself. So I went onto Instagram and I started my account, which I still have to this very day. And then I just started sharing my story. And not because I thought anyone was going to see it, but it was just like a diary.
Anytime and it's also that an accountability thing for yourself.
Oh, for sure. Mm. Anytime that I felt I was going to drink, anytime that I had been so proud of myself because I've been to my first party and I was the first to leave, because that was another thing. Africa never left.
Last to leave. I totally get that.
Oh my. So I would enter spaces, people love it. By the end, they're like, can someone
get
just
fouls? Get the fouls, just get her out.
Yeah. Never wanted to leave. So I'd be so proud of myself that I was able to leave, that I was able to say no, and I would just share. And then over time, people started reaching out to me, people that I knew in the past as well, telling me about their struggles with drugs. I had no idea.
Wow.
So yeah, I just started sharing my story on there, and I would read books, I would watch talks, I would find forums and kind of connect with people. I would use hashtags to see who was in London. But Instagram really, it changed my life. I think I was able to remain sober because of the community that I found.
And
on
that
there.
You built.
Yeah.
That's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people will resonate. It's like there's a spectrum and yet it seems quite black and white. It's like you're either a normal person that drinks or you're like powerless in an AA.
Right.
And I kind of was like, oh, I don't know, like where I land on the scale. So I constantly go from like that to like nothing.
Yeah.
And actually there's a massive thing in between. Like you say, people are becoming a lot more consciously aware.
Yes.
Systems are breaking down.
Yes.
And this is a huge part of it.
For
and
sure.
I think voices like yours are incredibly powerful to give people the courage to sort of change their way of behaving too.
Thank you, yeah.
How did you sort of alchemize that into like what you're doing now?
Yes, when I started to see other people sharing just how much me sharing was impacting them, I started to realize that actually I was not the one to blame. I started doing a lot of research just about alcohol and mindset in general. And then I was able to shift the blame for myself from myself and understand that it was much bigger than that. There were patterns within me that had to be healed. There was trauma that had to be addressed. There was a certain way in which I was socialized to believe that to get acceptance, I need to be this, I need to be that, all of those things. And once I started to learn that, I think I was able to start accepting myself and looking deeper into myself. And another thing that also happened around that same time is I realized that I had so much sexual shame, and the way that sexual shame manifested was that when I was still drinking, casual sex was also something that I really normalized. I felt like that was the only way for me to get connection, especially from men. So I felt so detached from my body, even though I was pretty much using my body very often. So by the time I got sober, I realized that was a huge area that I had to actually take a look at.
Do some work
huge,
on.
Huge.
Because if you'd been using the alcohol to then have that connection, then you take that away, it was probably pretty obvious that that was something that needed to be looked at.
Oh, absolutely. There was this book that I found, and I recommend this to everyone. It's called Women's Anatomy of Arousal by Sherry Winston. And this was a book that pretty much teaches you how to actually connect with your sexuality. Because again, I felt so detached from my sexuality. I thought that I couldn't have sex that I really enjoyed unless I was high or unless I was drunk. And because the first time that I had sex when I was 14, alcohol was a part of that as well. So it's almost like I started to associate alcohol and sex every single time.
But so many people do, because their first experience usually, I'm gonna generalize, is, you know, wrapped up in alcohol, because that lubricates the situation and you don't have those uncomfortable moments that you do when you're sober. But then it does create this association between sex and alcohol. And then even to like go even further and trying to dismantle that, there's the sort of patriarchy and how sex is, I think, sold through the male gaze from such a young age. You know, men now grow up watching porn. That's their idea of sexual intercourse, like from a very young age. That's their education on it. And so we go into it in this very like disconnected, unembodied way, and then wonder like why we have a lot of shame as a society around it, because the way we're practicing it is not right.
Yes. Oh my goodness. You nailed it. You nailed it. And it's also, for me as well, porn was my first teacher. And this all ties into kind of my sobriety and the kind of coaching that I do now and the way that I use my voice. But for me, porn was my first teacher at the age of 9. So by the time, and for so many people it is, and now it's even younger. So by the time I was 14, porn had kind of trained me in terms of what a woman's desire looks like, what my body should move like, what positions I should be in. And because alcohol was also as a performance, right? And also as something that is done to me, not something that I experience. So I was faking orgasms from the very beginning up until I was 25. And it's so normalized. Women laugh about it. So a year after I went sober. And, you know, I was faking them in my relationship. Oh, probably even more.
I think a lot of people were like,
it's so normalized.
But then also the problem with that, and this is, and it's a big topic that I want to be discussing on this season, is that if you fake orgasm and you continue along with that narrative that we all have sex like a porn star and that it just happens, this thing of kind of being slightly objectified in this whole performance, how are men ever going to know any different?
Right.
Like, we can get annoyed that, you know, oh, I faked it and he didn't actually make me. But if you don't communicate what your needs are, he's not going to know.
Right.
And then I think they get annoyed because they're like, they want to know.
Yeah.
But we don't give them that opportunity because we're so stuck in, oh, okay, this is what I've been sold since I was such a young girl. So this is what I have to keep doing.
Yeah. And it's because we don't feel like it's safe to communicate. And when you feel like it's not safe, you're not going to speak about it. Especially if it's someone that you love, you feel like, oh, but what if I upset them? What if they, you know, and we're always, especially as women, I mean, we just have to be very honest, we're conditioned into this niceness, right? Where we don't want to kind of bother.
Please.
We don't want to, so in getting sober for me, I realized that that was huge. And it wasn't
to reclaim
even
your
just
sexuality.
Oh, for sure. And I also realized that my sexuality wasn't even just about sex in itself, because I think that's a thinking that we have to kind of step out of, where we think sex and sexuality is about penis and vagina penetration. It's not. I truly believe it's like a life force. It's the way that you navigate the world. It's the way that you kind of harness your femininity. You know, by sharing all of those things, that's when I founded my company, Cherry Revolution.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So that was a result of me realizing that I needed to work through that sexual shame, not having anywhere to speak about it. No one was speaking about it. You know, the conversations would kind of stay in the living room, would stay in the restaurant, and then we just go out and fake orgasms again, and we will come back and talk about. So out of frustration, and I think a lot of incredible things are born out of a place of frustration and not seeing what it is you actually need and having to create it, I started talking about my pussy and harnessing the relationship with me actually referring to my body in ways that I've been told are shameful, mm-hmm. in ways that I've been told it's only okay if a man mm-hmm. is speaking about it, in ways where we're more comfortable with hearing pussy as an insult. It's just so weird. I just started to question everything.
Someone put up something on Instagram. It's like, okay, why is pussy associated as weakness?
Weak, yes.
When essentially it's the most powerful life force on earth.
It's,
and it can literally make a human come into this world.
It's so interesting. I always say, pay attention to whatever your response was when you heard that word. And it's okay, not out of judgment, but that can also signal whatever belief you have, right? Mm. It then started to serve as a permission slip for other people to do the same. So my sobriety and sexuality and doing more research into mindset and looking at the systems that we live under, it all kind of started to allow me to make peace with everything that I had experienced, to kind of give myself some grace.
How did you sort of unpack and let go of that shame that you had? Because I think quite a thing for a lot of people listening will be, you know, there is a huge connection between shame and sexuality.
Yeah.
If we've lived in a certain way and been behaving in a certain way up until a certain point, but then suddenly realise that we want to do things differently, how do we make peace with the past version of ourselves and let that go and then begin to truly embody like who we are and what we stand for in this moment?
Yes. Oh, that's a good question. For me, one of the biggest things I had to do was inner child work, because I realised that there was a part of myself, a very young part of myself, that had decided from a very young age that I wasn't enough. And making peace with myself personally wasn't about me doing it from where I was as a 24-year-old woman. I actually had to do the deeper work of going way back onto my timeline. And I know that for some people hearing this, it might sound like it's a lot of work, and that's because it fucking is. I think we need to realize that in order to actually really make peace, not on a superficial level, it's going to be hard.
But I sometimes think that people can just rehash the past and you can intellectualize it and make it make sense in your mind, but you actually haven't done the emotional body work.
Yes. Oh my goodness. That's exactly it. And I realized that I did have much deeper to go, but I still wasn't able to get deep enough. And because none of it was speaking to the subconscious,
relationship,
it was speaking to my conscious mind, right? And my analytical mind.
Which goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of like these internal belief systems. Like if you can't touch them, it doesn't matter how much you desire something or want something. It's like they're going to be essentially commandeering the shit.
Yeah. So for me, making peace was about actually getting to the root of what was happening. And for me, it was my beliefs. And they were beliefs that were not created in my 20s, beliefs that were formed when I was very young, beliefs that were formed because I grew up in a home where I saw physical abuse. And, you know, I made a lot of decisions about what that meant about me. That's when I discovered NLP. So you do a lot of timeline work where you go onto your timeline and look at the moment in which you made that decision about yourself. And I did a lot of kind of ritualistic stuff, like writing letters to that version of myself, to the version of myself that used to black out and lie and cheat and not know when to fucking leave a party. Because I had so much resentment towards that part of myself in the beginning of my sobriety, which is normal. And also because whenever I ran into people from the past, they
remind you who you used to be. Yeah, I know. I totally get that. And you're like, not that fucking person anymore.
And they don't always mean to. I feel like you have people that intentionally question your new path and they want to remind you, like, oh, come on, that's not really you.
I know who you truly are.
Right? And then there are people who do it it happens in a very subtle way, in a conversational way, but it triggers that part of you and you're like, no, I'm not that same person anymore. Or, you know, you might find yourself in situations where the things that you used to find funny, you just don't find funny anymore, but you have someone in front of you who is still speaking to you at that level that you used to be.
Because also that's a familiar comfort for them, because they're like, that's the role you play in my life as far as I'm concerned, especially if they haven't been on that path with you of your self-development.
Oh, Whereas instead of trying to get rid of them and talk shit about them and say, I'm not that person anymore, just kind of make peace with the fact that that is what you needed at the time. Believe it or not, that is actually what needed to happen.
It was a necessary tool to survive.
Oh, for sure. It's all you knew. And you were also doing the very best with what you had. Mm-hmm. That's something that I remind myself.
Because I read somewhere and I always find it very useful to come back to. It's like everyone's doing the best they can with the tools and self-awareness they have available. Mm. And so it's like, let's not berate ourselves for the past versions of ourselves when we didn't know any better.
Yes. I know for me,
I feel like we would have got on 5 years ago. I mean, we get on now in a very different way, but I feel like we would have had a lot of fun.
Right? Can I ask what you think was your biggest lessons, or even just some of the little things that you feel when you look back at that time, you're able to see that actually this had to happen, because if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't know this now.
I think it put me on a spiritual path.
Mm.
And I think for that, I'm eternally grateful. And it also encouraged me, or forced me, to cultivate relationships and also balance within myself, which were all like foreign concepts, really. Yeah. But what I describe to people now, if they're like, well, can you just casually drink? This is very dramatic, but it feels spiritually dark for me the next day. I guess that's one thing. And also, you know, it's really interesting everything you're saying about embodying those parts of ourselves that we deny. Like, because I'm a people pleaser, I can be quite shy.
Mm.
And I think that for me, alcohol was a way that I just like, I wasn't aware of what people were thinking, feeling, so I could just be whatever the fuck I wanted to be. And there was something liberating in that.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, how can I incorporate that into my life in, like you say, in a healthy way, mm-hmm. and be a little bit stronger and have like stronger boundaries and say no?
I would say it's when you're able to stand up for yourself, state your needs and to state your desires and to stand up for yourself in a way that feels quite scary, but in a way that frees you in so many ways. And I say that knowing full well that to state our needs and our desires often feels unsafe. So boundaries can seem quite disrespectful. They can seem like someone's being harsh, because we're not told that our needs are important. We're not told that it's important to actually say how you feel. If you're not okay with something, instead of just allowing it to happen, it can seem rude, or it can feel like a personal attack. But instead of it being in your mind, you actually express it, because there's a big difference. I think we confuse barriers for boundaries. And I think of barriers as when you know that you're not okay with this thing and this is not okay, and then you keep it in your mind and you don't actually express it. When I talk about saying no with yes energy, it's about saying no in a way that is in fear-based. It's not about saying no in a way where you're shrinking yourself with that no, but actually you're standing tall in that no and saying, I respect myself enough to not allow this to go ahead. And there are so many ways, right? It can be, I gracefully decline. I say, thank you for approaching me with this. It looks amazing. I can't wait to see how it turns out. But unfortunately, I don't have the capacity for that.
Okay, question. Does the energy come first or the language, or do they simultaneously kind of match up?
I believe the energy comes first.
Mm-hmm.
With everything,
you have to
feel it. Oh, for sure. With everything, I think it's energy
so true.
First.
And we also, I think if we don't check our energy, you know, going into a situation, I think we rehearse what we're going to say. But if we don't, like, people are responding to energy all the time, and language is just like the outer layer of that.
And I think it's also understanding that if I say yes to something that I don't want to be a part of, that is self-betrayal. If I fake an orgasm, that is self-betrayal. If I drink again, that is self-betrayal. And with the kind of awareness that I have and the identity that I'm trying to cultivate,
I don't see, for sure.
Because sometimes we think we have to wait for the big things to happen for us to start saying no, but it's the tiny little things that happen every single day. This is where also self-compassion comes in. When you notice these things about yourself and you're like, huh, noticing patterns, and then instead of berating yourself for the pattern, just actually look at it in an objective way. Just look at everything. This is what I do. And this ties in with the how do you make peace with yourself, is that I don't think the making peace happens once and then you're done. That's another important thing. You're constantly going to have to do that. Mm-hmm. So it has to be a practice. You have to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think we also get very overwhelmed when we realize just how much needs to be changed or how much we want to change something. And it often leads us into inaction, where we don't actually do anything at all. And we decide that this is just who I am. You know, yeah. I think that happens quite a lot.
Like take it or leave it.
Yeah, this is just who I am.
Because I think we're both examples of people that, like, if you want to change, you can.
You can. I remind people this all the time when they meet me at the level that I'm at now. And I just remind, you just have to scroll right down on the same page online that I have on Instagram to see where my day one was. Everything is still there. And you're able to actually see the progress, but you have to show up for it.
You have to show up for it.
You have to show up for it, even when you don't want to.
Mm, yeah. Which is quite a lot sometimes.
Oh, for sure.
We've unpacked a lot. I feel like I've learned really so much. Thank you so much for coming on.
This was amazing.
Adore you. Think you're amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you for gracing us with your pearls of wisdom.
Thank you. I loved this.
So if you enjoyed this episode with Africa, listen out for a mini episode that we have coming in the new year where we continue this conversation, but we'll be focusing more on the money mindset and professional life and our attitudes towards money and our relationship to it, really, on a very sort of energetic level. So watch this space, and thank you very much for listening. If you want to follow Africa on social media, you can find her at Africa Brooke and me at Kaggy's World. I also wanted to share some very exciting news with you guys. I'm going to be doing my first Saturn Returns with Kaggy live show in the new year, and it will be in line with the socially distanced guidelines. So please don't forget to check out my socials for more details on the Saturn Returns with Kaggy live show. Saturn Returns is a Feast Collective production. The producer is Scarlett O'Malley and the executive producer is Kate Taylor. Until next time, thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are not alone. Goodbye.